The Heart of Danger by Michael D. Cooper. Part 1. Under the Red Sun. Chapter 4. The Council Decides. The now familiar gut-wrenching feel of hyper-travel caused sudden relief to course through Zip's system. Tharsis had obviously sustained a damaging strike, but had survived and could still engage its hyperdrive. The journey took only seconds, and then he felt them enter ordinary space once again. Half-level light and power came on, obviously from the backup system. The Starman had been thrown down, but had managed to break his fall. He rose to his hands and knees. Zip saw Pleera lying flat and motionless a few feet away on the smooth floor of the command center, her head turned away from him. He crawled over to where she still lay unmoving. He didn't touch her in case her spine had been injured, but leaned over to peer anxiously into her face. There was a heavy purpling bruise over her left eye. Zip slipped over her so he could face her. Before giving her his attention again, he took a quick glance around the room. His friends were struggling out of their chairs. No one seemed to have been seriously injured. Two Amanians came close to Zip and gave attention to Pleera. Behind him, a voice called out, "Damage report." Information began to come into the command center, but Zip paid no attention. "We will take care of her," said a gentle voice next to Zip's ear. "She was very brave in battle, quick thinking under fire. We need her." Zip stood up as several people brought medical equipment over and began to treat the fallen Amanian. Reluctantly, the red-headed Starman turned away and joined his friends. "What's wrong with Pleera?" asked Mark, his eyes expressing sympathy and caring. "Hit her head," answered Zip. "She was knocked off her feet in the blast. She's unconscious. I don't know any more than that." "Let's get back to the conference," said Commander Lewis. "We can get more information later." Lewis, Katerite Gokwitha, and the three Starmen walked dejectedly back to the conference room. As they walked in, several people had just finished putting the room back in order. The janitor had apparently not moved. King Ismaka was just shutting down his personal communications system. He had concluded a private communication with the asteroid's personnel, from whom he had received a report on the attack and its aftermath. Taking his position at the head of the table, he beckoned everyone else to take seats. "Pleera has stationed us in the asteroid belt," he reported, "back in our first place of concealment. The Xenobots may search for us here, but they will not find it easy to detect us. If they search here, most likely we will become aware of their presence long before they can locate our position. They cannot take us by surprise. Moreover, when we left the orbit of Earth, we sent a holographic image of Ocean to the asteroid belt as a decoy. Perhaps they will not think to look here first." The leader of the Amanians paused, and his eyes swept the table briefly, looking at each one in turn. "The attack on Ocean was massive and well-planned. Frankly, I did not consider the Xenobots had the capability to do such careful strategizing. It is disconcerting to learn that they retain an ability to cooperate to the degree necessary for such an operation as we have just seen. They nearly succeeded in destroying this asteroid. We escaped their assault with only seconds to spare. As it is," he grimaced and lifted his hands, "as it is, we are badly damaged. Numerous laser spikes have pitted the surface deeply with craters and grooves, and two nuclear detonations were close enough to weaken the walls of Ocean to the danger point. There are cracks in the iron shell through which the atmosphere is leaking slowly. If Pleera had not risked sending a half-strength electromagnetic pulse in the last few seconds, thereby causing the missiles to explode prematurely, we would have been lost. Her timing was exquisite." The President spoke up. "Can this marvel of engineering be repaired, sir?" "Yes, Mr. President," said Ismaka, "but it will take a matter of weeks. All airlocks on Ocean were shielded by individual systems as a backup to the Great Shield, so they are undamaged by the laser strikes. One, however, was destroyed by a nuclear explosion. That will have to be repaired. For the rest, our crews must locate several iron asteroids to use as raw material to fortify the weak places and fill in the craters we sustained in the attack. Of course, a complete damage report is not yet available, but we should have one by the end of the day. Dr. Stephen Hoshino raised his hand. Our circumstances have changed, perhaps even significantly in the light of this attack, he said. But the original issue still remains. We must prevent the Xenobots from installing a solar power station in orbit around our sun. If we can learn how one of these solar power stations transfers energy to the Xenobot ships, we may be able to disrupt the process. Our current defenses may be adequate, but certainly no more than that. We must continue to work on devising a shield around the sun. A shield around the sun? Mark was amazed at the concept. What kind of shield? How could one possibly be created? Richard Starlight spoke up. Do you have any suggestions, Ancient One? The janitor of the first races had been silent and unmoving since he had declared the Xenobots were attacking the asteroid, yet he had remained fully present throughout the disastrous battle. You have two resources that you have not drawn from yet. The crystals that the Starmen brought back from the Lucian moon, where they had been held prisoner, are used for data storage. In crystalline format, data will not deteriorate over time, but can remain to be read for countless eons. I suggest that you examine the crystals and read the information they contain. The crystals were most likely written in the early ages of the Lucian's corruption, and therefore at the height of their power. In those days they were beautiful, but cruel and utilitarian. Now they are dull and shrewd, but with cruelty grown into savagery and ruthlessness. Information from their early years may be revealing. Our technicians have studied these crystals, Ancient One, began Sidervo, but have made little headway. We have used crystal technology to store data before, but frankly, even our knowledge of light has not permitted us to open the secrets of these venerable artifacts. Data storage on crystals such as these was common in the age of the first races, Sidervo, stated the janitor. The Lucians used this method as did the other four first races. Crystal technology is not unknown to me, though I was among the least skilled of my race in these matters. Perhaps I can prove of some assistance to the Amanian Masters of Light as you seek to plumb the mysteries of these particular crystals. Indeed, I venture to think that without my assistance your race will be able neither to gain access to the data soon nor read the meaning, even if you do. We would be honored to have your assistance, eldest. Will you come to Amanya? I will. And the other resources that we have not consulted, asked Ismaka? The Alzenta, the humans heard the word as Griegels, retain the records of the First Age. Manufactured by the first races and given artificial intelligence, perhaps much of the knowledge of that era that I never had may be found there. A satisfying light of recognition shone in the faces of the Almanians. But eldest, began Sidervo, our contact with the Alzenta has been tantalizing but unrewarding. They hold aloof from nearly all who live in the solar system. They appear to be neutral or even indifferent to our struggles. They are friendly with only one person, an unusual human who lives near them. When you approached them before, responded the janitor, you did not have me. I am of the race that manufactured them. Although it has been uncountable eons since they were made, my presence will make a difference. Gradually, during the course of the ongoing conversation, the atmosphere of shock that was present after their headlong flight from the Xenobots had subtly altered to one of moderate hopefulness. Clearly, we must go to the Alzenta, said Carex, but that undertaking must not deter us from our first duty. Now that Raphon Dorn is among us, we must retrieve the Key of Ossan. Had we had it in our possession, we need not have feared the recent attack by Xenobots. You speak truly, affirmed Ismaka. Indeed, this is our most easily achievable goal and our most urgent. Retrieving the key must be our first duty. "Sir?" queried Mark tentatively. Ismaca turned his eyes to the starman. "Forgive me, what is this key?" "The key," began Ismaca, "is the brain of Ocean. When it is installed, it allows the many systems in Ocean to run in coordination. Indeed, there are several systems that cannot run at all without the key. Had the key been installed during the attack, we would not have needed ordinary laser shields. Instead, we could have captured most of the laser light of our enemy and used it ourselves for energy. The key also increases the power of the drive manifold by shifting energy more swiftly and effectively. For example, when the key is installed, the hyperdrive does not need charging. It is ready for immediate use. Without it, Ocean is a huge machine. With it, Ocean is almost an organism. It has artificial intelligence and can be attuned to its commander. It is because of the key that we were able to attain victory in our counter-assault upon the Xenobot's planet in Omega Centauri. Why was it ever removed? A pained expression crossed the features of the Amanian king. "Starman Seton," he began sorrowfully, "when we returned from Omega Centauri completely victorious in a time that seemed to my waking memory but a few months ago, we found our beloved planet a scorching ruin. Although we had prepared for that possibility, few of us ever really believed that our plan would have to be enacted. In order for the remnants of our race to survive on a planet that could no longer sustain life, most of our citizens had to be put into a state of stasis. Only the guardians of our 16 refuges and a few others remained awake and aware through the generations." Mark looked down at the table. He knew the story, but he hadn't anticipated that he'd be bringing up the grief of planetary genocide when he inquired about the key of Tharsis. He was embarrassed and acutely uncomfortable. He felt a hand on his shoulder. He looked up into the compassionate face of Sinya, the king's sister. Sensing the starman's discomfort, she had quietly arisen and come to where he was sitting. She was smiling. He smiled back at her gratefully, and then gave his attention back to Ismaca. "When the citizens of Olivanda were put under suspension, the asteroid that was home of this city was concealed in the asteroid belt. Ocean also was to sleep the sleep of patience. Out of more than 400,000 citizens, fewer than 500 would be left awake. These are too few to operate Ocean with all its power, and were not trained to defend it in battle should such a remote possibility ever come to pass. The key, therefore, was withdrawn and hidden so that Ocean could not be operated in its full power by any other than Amanians." Zip suddenly looked up in shock. He realized that the remote possibility that Ismaca had mentioned had indeed transpired. George St. George had discovered the asteroid, and Troy Putnam had learned to operate its basic systems. His successor, Lurton Zimbardo, had driven it out of the asteroid belt, and in his madness directed it on a collision course with Earth. As the realization hit him, Zip gasped aloud. His face paled, and his few freckles stood out. "Yes, Starman Foster," said Ismaca. "If we had not hidden the key, the pirates would have conquered Mars and Earth with ease. Both our races can be grateful that we had the foresight to remove and conceal the key to Ocean, but now the time has come to retrieve it." Where is it hidden?" Zip asked. "It was encased in black ice and secreted in the rings of Saturn. It has swung through space and tumbled among many billions of identical chunks of ice for more than 12,000 years. Why was it not retrieved before now? The Amanians who were not suspended were those whose skills were necessary for the preservation of our race during its time of hypersleep. They were most carefully selected for that purpose. The retrieval of the key and its installation on Ocean requires rare knowledge and skill. Few Amanians have what is needed. Indeed, only one now awake can perform this task. You mentioned a name a moment ago, contributed Mark. Yes, it is he, Raphon Dorn. The process of awakening him was initiated 2 years ago. He is aboard Ocean now for this very purpose. A long period of silence followed this revelation as all present reflected on the image of this Amanian artifact circling the sixth planet, waiting through many lifetimes of the race that built and hid it until the time it would be wanted again. Then Dr. Stephen Hoshino spoke up. If I may sum up, we have decided on two courses of action. With the assistance of the Amanians, the janitor will visit Adamant and speak to the Griegels about reading the crystal Starman Taylor has brought us, and then he will go to Amania to attempt to decipher them. It is a good plan and must be done, but the endeavor may be fruitless or, if successful, may provide no useful information. We will also go and install the key to Tharsos. If the Xenobots' memories or histories are good enough, they now know that the asteroid they attacked today is far weaker than the weapon they faced thousands of years ago. Today's attack may even have been a test of our capability and may explain why the Xenobots appeared in waves instead of one great armada all at once. It is essential, therefore, that this asteroid be fitted once again with the key so that they cannot take us by surprise again. Indeed, from a tactical point of view, our near defeat and our ignominious flight may work very much to our advantage. But there remains still the most important question. Hoshino's bunched fingers tapped the tabletop to underscore every word of his last sentence. His face was grim. All this will count for nothing more helpful than space gas if the Xenobots place a solar power station around our sun. He waited a moment, quickly scanning the faces of everyone at the table. No one moved. Therefore, he said, I have a proposal. Once the key is installed, I want us to take this near impregnable weapon to the Xenobot Empire and capture a solar power station. I want to study it, take it apart, learn how it works, discover how to keep it from working. The astrophysicist's expression presented the group with a challenge. For a long time, no one said anything. Then, by jingo, Joe Taylor's hand slapped down on the table. His eyes were light. I want to go on that expedition. It is possible, came the words of the janitor into everyone's minds. In the Xenobot Empire, there are star systems long conquered and even now nearly lifeless. Around the suns of these systems, there are solar power stations in orbit. The Xenobots believe now that we are weak, said Richard Starlight. If they have the slightest vestige of logic left in them, an attack by a strong Tharsos in their own empire would be completely unexpected and demoralizing. Dr. Hoshino's proposal was discussed for over an hour. There were objections and reservations, but at the end the consensus was to go forward with the strategy. Then, concluded the astrophysicist, while Tharsos is undergoing repair, let us install the necessary apparatus for capturing a Xenobot solar power station. If our mission is successful, we can return with it through hyperspace to a location of our choosing. King Ismaka added a warning. In the first Xenobot war in which I fought, no Amanian was ever able to capture a solar power station. They always self-destructed before we could get at them. The success of your mission requires that you overcome that difficulty. Dr. Hoshino blinked and stared at the tabletop. I thrive on tough assignments, stated Joe.